loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we'll talk about the growing danger of war with Iran. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made a speech today arguing that Iran is in violation of the nuclear arms deal as Donald Trump prepares for a possible end of compliance with the agreement. Israel carried out major military strikes against Iranian forces in Syria. The bombing was so big that it created an earthquake. We'll also talk about Mike Pompeo's trips to Saudi Arabia and Israel this weekend. And then in our second half hour, we discuss Joel Whitney's book, Finks, How the CIA Tricked the World's Best Writers. It describes a situation that few Americans know about, how in the early days of the Cold War, and in fact throughout the Cold War, the CIA clandestinely recruited some of the greatest writers of the world. We'll talk to the author about why this happened and why it's been a secret for so long.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Mumia Abu-Jamal has been in prison in Pennsylvania since 1981. He was on death row until 2011 when his sentence was converted to life without parole. Mumia and his supporters have always maintained his innocence, and he was in court today in Philadelphia. He's asking a judge there to vacate his previous appeals attempts on the basis of judicial bias so that he can appeal the case again. Next, the attorney for a right-wing organization that sues for conservative causes has filed a lawsuit against Arizona's teachers, contending that their strike is illegal and seeking to force them back to work. But teachers remained on the picket line today, the third day of the strike. They're dissatisfied with a modest pay raise proposed by Governor Ducey. Then we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. Today, he focuses on a trip to the opening of the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, a museum and memorial in Montgomery, Alabama, that honors the memory of lynching victims and asks localities to publicly acknowledge that they occurred. And then Admiral Harry Harris has been nominated to be Donald Trump's next ambassador to South Korea, an outrageous idea for a man who presided over the torture at the Guantanamo military base. We'll look into his record. And finally, Randy Credico was invited to the White House Correspondents' Dinner over the weekend as a guest of Yahoo News. But the Washington swells didn't like Randy's message of freedom for Julian Assange, and they unceremoniously threw him out of the event. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. And in other headlines, a caravan of asylum-seeking refugees from Central America has arrived at the U.S.-Mexico border, and they are demanding entry into the United States. Opposition to the caravan has become a focus for the political right wing in recent days, and President Trump has frequently spoken out against the refugees. Trump has sought to use the controversy to push for the construction of his signature border wall project. At least 29 people have been killed in two suicide bombings that hit the Afghan capital Kabul today. The first bomb detonated near the headquarters of Afghanistan's intelligence service, while the second exploded in the same location to target first responders. ISIS has claimed responsibility for the attack. At a rally in Michigan on Saturday, Donald Trump talked about shutting down the government if he doesn't get his border wall, saying, quote, "If we don't get border security, we'll have no choice. We'll close down the country because we need border security," unquote. He also noted during the rally, quote, "We are doing things that are good," unquote. Former Trump advisor and billionaire Carl Icahn owns an oil refinery that received a financial hardship waiver that exempts the facility from a federal biofuels law. This exemption means the refinery can skip adding biofuels to their gasoline and diesel products. These biofuels lessen air pollution and reduce petroleum imports. They also make use of corn products from the nation's corn farmers, who are represented by a strong lobby in Washington. Additionally, Icahn is under investigation for trying to influence the biofuels policy while serving as a Trump advisor. Those are today's headlines. Next up is Secretary of State Pompeo's visit to Saudi Arabia and Israel, plus Netanyahu's comments on Iran today. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
But first, we turn to the growing possibility of confrontation between the United States and Iran, the United States and Israel and Iran, the United States Israel and Saudi Arabia and Iran, Secretary of State and former CIA Director Michael Pompeo continued his tour of the Middle East over the weekend with stops in Israel and Saudi Arabia, among other places. Pompeo has taken a consistently hard line on Palestine and Iran. He endorsed Israeli attacks against Palestinian civilians and said that the U.S. is ready to pull out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Also, Benjamin Netanyahu made what he called a significant or major speech today, outlining Israeli assertions that indeed they had taken 55,000 pages of archives from the Iranian, what they call the Iranian nuclear program from the past. Are we getting ready, setting the stage for a new major confrontation in the Middle East? We're joined from Washington by Medea Benjamin. She's the co-founder of Code Pink and the author of the book Kingdom of the Unjust, Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connection. And we're joined from Beirut by journalist and independent political analyst Marwa Osman. Marwa and Medea, welcome to Loud and Clear.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks.
Marwa, let's start with you. We know you have a tight schedule and you may have to leave in a few minutes. There were big attacks by Israel inside of Syria. You have Pompeo's tour. Now you have today Netanyahu's speech, very bellicose speech. Where are we going?
We have an extravaganza of rhetoric and hegemony in our region right now that is increasing by the hour. I mean, I'm pretty sure you watched and you saw the very nice presentation that I actually, one of my students in freshman year could do better than that. But I'm sure you saw what Netanyahu did concerning the presentation about how Iran is lying about the nuclear deal. To be honest with you, we all had our laughs. We all made fun. But to be honest with you, this was the most insulting 15 to 20 minutes for the IAEA that I've ever heard a person insult them so much in so little amount of time. I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu was basically saying that every inspector investigative team that went into Iran to try and mediate the nuclear deal by saying that Iran whether has or does not have, acquires or does not acquire a nuclear weapon, basically is either a liar or an idiot. That's what he said, because he was talking about when he unveiled the amazing files and the CDs. I mean, and before that, when he unveiled where those CDs and files were taken from, what kind of people does he think we are? That's number one. And number two, does he really think that with such a presentation, he will be able to wage war against Iran or against Iranian presence in Syria, for that matter? I mean, Netanyahu, Israel, has been attacking Syria nonstop for the past 6 years, if not for the past 7 years, but let's say with documented evidence, 6 years. And lately, last night at 10 p.m., with new weaponry, the weaponry that was used was very similar to the one that was used by al-Saud on Sana'a, which is similar to a Moab, which is similar to either depleted uranium or some sort of a enhanced nuclear weapon that was used yesterday in Aleppo. You could see the footage, you could see the evidence, you could also see the kind of weapon that was used on these facilities, and they claim to be targeting Iranian Revolutionary Guard inside of these facilities. They have been going wild for the past 2 weeks. They have been targeting Syria, specifically Iranian forces inside of Syria, just to provoke an Iranian response. And to be honest, I don't think there will be any sort of a response in the upcoming few days because of certain political issues happening in the Middle East. But what Netanyahu is trying to do, he's begging for a war with the help of Pompeo. And by the way, he's trying to drag Trump into it now. We could also conclude that by the end of the presentation that he made. He's trying so hard to put an open, provoking a war, an open confrontation between U.S. and Iran. But he's also saying that if you don't want to do it, I'm ready to do it. You just give me the green light to do it. This is a man who has gone insane. And I think his own public right now, the Israeli colonial settlers in Israel, are freaking out as we speak. They are in paranoia. And I don't think they will allow him to conduct any sort of a risk for their existence to begin with and for the region in general.
Medea Benjamin, when I was in the CIA, a year before hostilities in Iraq, a decision was made to attack that country. The CIA director informed station chiefs around the world and that the planning began. Well, several months before we actually physically attacked Iraq, We started this sort of drumbeat of propaganda. We went to the United Nations. We made it seem as though we wanted a UN Security Council resolution. In fact, we didn't care one way or the other. I'm seeing parallels today between what's happening with the Iranians and what happened with the Iraqis 15 years ago. Am I crazy, or do you think this is deja vu?
Unfortunately, we're seeing a repeat of disastrous history where the U.S., Israel, and Saudi Arabia are all trying to present as facts what is really justifications for a war they already want to do. We have seen that Mike Pompeo and John Bolton have years ago talked about bombing Iran. Mike Pompeo did it. John Bolton did it in a New York Times op-ed saying to get rid of Iran's bombs, you have to bomb Iran. They are also thinking that because the economy in Iran is weak, which is they're doing, the U.S. doing, that this is a time to really hit them hard. And I think they're under the illusion, just as they were under the illusion back in 2002, that they could easily overthrow Saddam Hussein and put a new government in place. I think they think that they can overthrow, or the quote, people of Iran will get rid of this government, and then somehow, miraculously, a U.S. Western-friendly government would be put in place without massive chaos. So this is deja vu all over again, and it is very dangerous.
I'm looking, John, at the Haaretz newspaper, Israeli, one of the papers in Israel. Here's the headline. Analysis, serious strike, colon, winds of war in Jerusalem with backing from Washington. Subtitle, Israel is determined to oust Iran from Syria, but if it miscalculates, Hezbollah and Hamas could be thrown into the ring. Netanyahu is prepared to undertake risks bordering on gambling. And then they talk about, this is the fifth time since September, the most recent attack, a big attack this time by Israeli Air Force in Syria. This attack, Medea, set off an earthquake. It was like registered like 2.7 or something on the Richter scale. In other words, very, very, very big explosions. There's a lot of feelings by people who are paying attention to this, and Marwa sort of alluded to it, that what the Israelis are really trying to do is provoke Iran to respond, which then would make Iran appear to be the aggressor. Right now, Iran is holding back. It even denied that its forces had been targeted in the explosion, even though I think others in the Syrian media said that was precisely what happened. And then you have Pompeo and John Bolton and Donald Trump. When you put it all together, it's very dangerous sounding. But unlike Iraq, Iran is a country of 80 million people.
Exactly.
It's got a very advanced military. Iran had been hobbled by economic sanctions for 13 long years before the invasion. It was surrounded, didn't really have allies. Yes, it seems like deja vu all over again. And yet there are profound differences. I mean, this is a much bigger fish to fry, so
yes,
to speak.
It is.
Go ahead, Medea.
Certainly. The situation right now is that I think the Europeans did not do an adequate job when they came here to talk to Trump. Who knows what went on behind closed doors, but certainly at the press conferences, they allowed Trump to talk about this Iran nuclear deal as ridiculous, insane, something that should never have been signed. Instead of saying, we are going to go ahead with this deal, whether the U.S. is or not, we're going to create the financial institutions so that our companies can do business with Iran without being jeopardized by secondary sanctions from the United States. And a deal is a deal. They went home empty-handed and seemingly opening the way now for Netanyahu and the Saudis to be filling in with the justification of why we should not believe the IAEA, who in 10 different reports have asserted that Iran is complying. So all this is being set up by the U.S., Israel, and the Saudis, and this will be an absolute disaster. The Iranians have been preparing for a bombing for a long time. They know where U.S. troops are stationed throughout the region. Hezbollah obviously knows where they are. They could immediately retaliate, both attacking Israel and attacking U.S. troops and bases all over the Middle East. This could get really nasty, really awful. And I don't see the U.S. Congress doing anything about it. I don't see the Europeans doing enough about it. And I wonder, where is Russia and China right now?
You know, and she's exactly right. Where are Russia and China? Where's France? Because Macron said this morning that he's going to work with the Iranians to convince everybody else, if they can't convince Trump, that the deal ought to remain intact. You know, I think a very important strategic error that this administration is making here, well, it's several fold. Number one, they're making an assumption that the American people want this, that we want to go to war with yet another country. This would be three active wars all at the same time. Second, this is a war of choice. The Iranians have not attacked us. The Iranians are actually abiding by the deal. And the inspectors say that at every opportunity, that they are abiding by the deal. So again, this is a war that is illegal when looking at international law. It's a war of choice, and it's a political decision rather than a military one.
But what worries me is that the U.S. has so demonized Iran,
yes,
in the eyes of the American people, that they, if you asked, would you rather side with Israel and Saudi Arabia, our great allies, or with the devil Iran? Unfortunately, I think too many Americans have bought the propaganda that Iran is an enemy of the United States. So, yes, I think Trump is playing into some domestic base that on one level doesn't want war, but on another level, if he can say, we are dealing with North Korea because there we can really get the kind of concessions we want, but we can't deal with unreasonable Iran. It makes no sense to us, those of us who know what's really going on, but I'm afraid that Americans might get hoodwinked.
You know, another thing that really troubles me, Medea, is Quinnipiac came out with a poll this morning on the most popular politicians or political figures in America. And I don't think any of our listeners could possibly guess who is the most popular political figure in our country right now. It's Nikki Haley, who is viewed positively overall by 63% of voters, including 55% of Democrats. So if people are looking to Nikki Haley.
Who's, that's Quinnipiac?
Yeah, Quinnipiac.
I don't know.
And they're good.
I don't know. I can't believe that.
They're good.
First of all, I think most people in America don't know who Nikki Haley is.
I think that's probably true. But of the ones who do, they're looking to Nikki Haley for leadership on these foreign policy issues. And she's been doing nothing but beating the drums of war since she took that position.
That is very true. Trump has just issued a statement. He will not rule out negotiating a new Iran deal, he says. But this comes in coordination and tandem with Netanyahu's speech, where, as Marwa said at the beginning of the program, I mean, it looked like a freshman in high school presentation, like with those big loopy graphics showing this, that, and the other thing. Sort of like what Netanyahu did at the UN when he had that cartoon figure of a bomb.
Which looks ridiculous to us, but is eaten up by a lot of others. And when he stands in front of a huge screen that just says Iran lied, that's the optic that gets put out all over the world on the TV screens. So I do get worried that these elementary type show and tell presentations are done by people who have PhDs in propaganda. They know what they're doing. And unfortunately, our media tends to eat it up.
Yeah, you're right. You're totally right there. Trump has also said today that the U.S. likely withdrawal from the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, that's the Iran nuclear arms deal, would send a, quote, positive signal to North Korea.
Right.
Let's let that sink in. Yesterday, John Bolton on a Sunday morning news show said the U.S. was thinking about using Libya as the model for North Korea. Okay, so what's John Bolton doing, Medea Benjamin? I mean, Of course, Libya gave up its weapons of mass destruction, or they didn't even have them, but they agreed that they would have U.S. and British inspectors come in and verify that they didn't have a weapons program. They did all kinds of other sort of neoliberal deals with Western corporations. They let them in. And in exchange, the U.S., Britain, and France bombed the heck out of Libya, dropped thousands and thousands of missiles and bombs, and finally it only ended with the lynching of the head of state, Gaddafi, in the streets. Why would John Bolton be using Libya as the model for North Korea? Is he trying to just provoke North Koreans and have North Korea say, wait, because North Korea has always used what happened to Libya as the reason that they had to have nuclear weapons.
President Trump has also said that North Korea will not be looking at Iran. They don't care what's happening with Iran. Of course, they're looking at Iran. And while Bolton and Trump say that Iran came to the table because of the successful bullying that the U.S. did, the North Koreans are saying we came to the table because we got a nuclear weapon. We did what we set out to achieve, and now we're in a position to negotiate. And, of course, Iran is not in that position to negotiate because Iran does not have a nuclear weapon. So it is clear to many people and countries around the world that the only way to get the U.S. to negotiate is to get a nuclear weapon.
I just wonder where we're leading, where we're going. You know, I felt, and the people working with me in the Answer Coalition felt, a year before the invasion, or certainly, a year before the invasion, that there was going to be an invasion of Iraq, maybe earlier than that. And we started organizing protests a year before. But you could see that the United States, having gone to war against Iraq in 1991, had sort of crossed the threshold, felt, okay, Iraq is weak enough that they could do it, that Baghdad would fall in a few weeks. Tehran is not going to fall in a few weeks.
Absolutely not.
So Medea, from a military point of view, what are we talking about? Because if you're not going to have military forces on the ground, hundreds of thousands or millions of troops invading Iran, the only other thing would be missile strikes or bombing of Iran facilities. Is that the plan?
So there could be the plan to bomb Iran's facilities at the same time to put more pressure on the sanctions. The economy is in bad shape. Just in the last 6 months, the rial lost 25% of its value. One of the Israeli officials just said now is the time to increase the sanctions on Iran. Iranians won't go hungry like the North Koreans, meaning they won't let their government stand and go hungry like North Korea. So if you bomb some of the facilities, if you keep pressuring them with economic sanctions, the people will rise up and overthrow their government. We've heard that before. We've seen that before. These scenarios are indeed filled with chaos, uncertainty, and calamity.
John, the U.S. CIA and British intelligence did overthrow a democratically elected government in Iran in 1953.
Yes.
There were sanctions because the government of Mohammad Mossadegh, the democratically elected prime minister, dared to nationalize the Anglo-Iranian oil company, AIOC, now known as British Petroleum.
BP. Yes, indeed.
They dared to do that. And for that, that a sin of having taken control of their own oil resources, the British and CIA overthrew Iran's government. They put into power the Shah of Iran, 26 years of tyrannical monarchical rule. The CIA ran the intelligence services, the SAVAK. Medea is suggesting that's the plan right now, regime change. I put enough pressure on Iran of all types, including military strikes, more sanctions, that it will do the same thing. But I don't think it will do the same thing. I don't think that's in the cards.
Well, I think that Medea is right, that the point is not going to be pinprick precision missile strikes. The point is regime change. I think the point is not to launch a ground invasion, but it is to bomb the country's infrastructure to the point where the right wing at the White House hopes that people rise up in the streets and overthrow the government.
So you destroy the infrastructure.
That's the infrastructure.
I mean, you know, in the run-up to the 1991 Iraq War, remember General Michael Dugan from the Air Force actually mm-hmm. revealed that the U.S. was going to bomb the sanitation system, yep. the electrical grid, all these things far away from Kuwait.
Back to the Stone Age,
he said. Back to the Stone Age. And we learned this from other documents that we were able to find, as a supplement to sanctions. So then if you destroy the infrastructure and then the country can't buy parts and it can't buy medicine and it can't buy energy.
That was the plan all along.
You bring it down. Go ahead, Medea. We have about 2.5 minutes left.
The folks like Bolton and Pompeo and Trump were delighted when they saw the Iranian protests that happened at the end of last year and the beginning of January, and hoped that they would spread around the country and would result in a real uprising. So they have been feeding opposition groups within Iran ever since the 1979 revolution. John Bolton has been openly supportive of the terrorist group, the MEK, putting them forward as if they had some kind of legitimacy and support within Iran, which is absolutely false. So I think just as they were delusional around Iraq, they've never been held accountable for what they've done. And so here they are being delusional again about Iran. Are we going to be able to stop them is the real question that I have. Is the world community going to be able to stop them? I mean, that's what we have to hope for.
Well, you know, the question really is, are Americans going to believe this propaganda coming out of the White House and the mainstream media, that this is somehow a war of necessity, that we have to launch a war against Iran to somehow protect ourselves? And I don't know the answer to that. I think many, many Americans are gullible. They want to believe their leaders. They don't do research on their own. And they're just going to go along with this like lemmings.
Well, also, the corporate-owned media is like an echo chamber for all of this demonization and war preparation. And then you have, you know, Sputnik. And now RT is like taken off the air in the Washington, D.C. metro area, along with Chinese TV. You know, there's an attempt to silence alternative media because the American people need alternative media. You can't combat the dominant media narrative without any other media. So that's why the work that Medea is doing and the work that other people are doing is so important. One final note, Medea, we have about a minute left. Remember in 2009, this goes back to what you were saying, when the Green Movement was challenging the election of Ahmadinejad the second time, there was big street protests by that segment of the Iranian population that was hostile, very hostile to the government. Twitter was going to take a maintenance break, and Hillary Clinton called Twitter and said, don't take the maintenance break because the Iranian street protests were using Twitter to coordinate street level activity. I mean, that seems like meddling in another country's elections. But again, the purpose from the point of view of Hillary Clinton, who doesn't, I think, care at all about democracy or human rights anywhere, was really just regime change. Anyway, 30 seconds left, Medea.
The U.S., Israelis, and the Saudis want regime change in Iran. They have been preparing for this for a long time. They are now feeding us the more elements of the propaganda to be justifying this. And they are hoping that they can get away with getting out of the Iran nuclear deal, making Iran look like it's the bad one, because then Iran hardliners there will say, let's go back to having our nuclear program. And that will justify a bombing campaign. So it looks bad, and we've got to wake up and get out on the streets and get Congress to do something as well to stop this from happening.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That was the voice of Medea Benjamin. She's the co-founder of Code Pink and the author of the book Kingdom of the Unjust, Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connection. We were joined earlier from Beirut by journalist and independent political analyst Marwa Osman. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
In this half hour, we're going to talk about a very important book. The book is entitled Finks, How the CIA Tricked the World's Best Writers, by Joel Whitney from Brooklyn, New York. He is a co-founder of Guernica, a magazine of arts and politics. Joel Whitney, great pleasure to have you with us. Thanks for joining.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's first ask you about the title, Finks, How the CIA Tricked the World's Best Writers. It's published by OR Books, and you can buy it at orbooks.com. Talk about the title, why you started writing this book.
Yeah, I've gotten a lot of questions about the title, particularly around the word tricked. Some people who maybe thought that was begging the question of what the CIA's intentions were. And I tried to talk about the title and that word in terms of a conversation that doesn't really get into intentions, because I think when you have a conflict such as the context of the book, which is the Cold War, both sides, any side, can claim that its intentions are in the right place. So I tried to look at the actions, and I looked at how writers, and particularly writers publishing in magazines, were affected by this thing called the Cultural Cold War, where both sides were trying to use the cachet of culture to win over the opponents.
I'm interested, too, in how you were able to do all of this research. You know, so much of what you write seems to me to at least have once been classified. Where did you find the information?
That's a great question. I did some archival research in various university archives for the most part. Some of the research around the main sort of group of characters surrounding the Paris Review magazine, those archives were at the Morgan Library. But then what I really did was a lot of hunting for names and indexes of biographies to see, because a lot of biographies about the intellectuals of the Cold War would mention the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which was one of the CIA's propaganda fronts, in passing. And then if you stitch that together, you started to see a kind of more robust story of what really happened to these writers and how they felt about it. That was one of my key questions.
Tell us also a little bit about the Paris Review. That, to me, that was the most interesting thing in the entire book, that the Paris Review was actually a CIA front organization, but none of the principals in it even realized that they were working for the CIA.
Well, maybe one or two of them did, though.
Yeah, that's the question, is whether they did or not and when they did. So that's exactly what makes it so interesting, is sort of solving that unsolved mystery. Up front, I'll say one of the reasons I framed it around the Paris Review was because that magazine still exists, unlike, right, I think, all of the other ones. So that became key to show that there's still a hangover from this debauchery that Americans went through with the Russians on the other side. Another reason I was interested in the Paris Review is because as a young writer, and particularly as a recent graduate of the poetry program at Columbia University, that was one of the first publications that was a feather in my hat as a young poet. So I had an affinity for the magazine, but my initial assumption starting out was that if we want to give the Cold Warriors a pass for intentions, which there's no reason not to, it's just not the main question, then the question becomes, well, what actually happened when people around magazines like the Paris Review lent some of their cachet, lent some of their pages? Did they know? Didn't they know? These were the questions I was interested in. What happens when that happens? And so the Paris Review was founded actually by Peter Matheson, but George Plimpton became its public face. And in a nutshell, what you see at some point in the 60s are these letters which have been unearthed by a documentarian named Emmy Humes, who was the daughter of one of the founders. One of them started asking questions in the 60s, and it's around the same time that people like Seymour Hersh and sort of totally independent magazines like Ramparts are starting to unearth what the CIA is doing in terms of penetrating cultural groups, penetrating student groups, penetrating labor unions, not just overseas where it was at least arguably legal, but at home where it was definitely not, according to the spirit of the law, very legal. So one of these questioners was a founder. His name was Doc Humes. He was there before Plimpton became the public face of the magazine. And he wrote a letter to both Plimpton and Matheson, two very famous writers, asking them to come clean. And I think what you see in George Plimpton's response is that it wasn't feasible. It wasn't going to be good for the magazine, for the magazine to confess that one of its founders, Peter Matheson, had started as a cover for his covert activity in Paris as a CIA agent.
I will say that unearthing information like this is very, very difficult. It's only just in the last couple of years that the CIA has finally come clean on the one and only Russian translation of Dr. Zhivago, that it was the CIA that translated Dr. Zhivago into Russian and then used the papal nuncio to smuggle copies of it into the Soviet Union, that the CIA was then establishing legitimate periodicals like the Paris Review is new information, as far as I'm concerned.
That's the thing. It's been unearthed in piecemeal style over the last several decades. So it once in a while, it takes kind of a, I was trying to put together the different geographies that were involved, how it affected different regions, how it affected different generations of the Cold War intellectuals, how it had links up to our interventions in Afghanistan and what the sort of aftermath would be going forward from the 90s. But yeah, I had some happy little eureka moments in my research, and I had the same spirit you just described in terms, I had the same sense that this was not known to a lot of people, and parts of it have been out there for a long time. Even starting with the Ramparts revelations, Ramparts magazine was on the trail of this as early as the 60s. And what really interested me about Ramparts revealing it was that I didn't think my generation and folks younger who were sort of coming of age during college and then after college, for me it was after college, as sort of where you get your information from the internet. So I didn't think this story was told at all, me being a founder of an online magazine, to the internet generation. And so piecing it together was something that interested me. And it still seems that it makes people kind of confused. Like, why would literature matter? And I guess the times have changed so much. These neoliberal times we're in, where, you know, the humanities themselves have probably been thrown aside, whether the people are responsible for the Western canon. I mean, this idea that the Western canon mattered was maybe one of the more charming and quaint ideas of the Cold War. You know, the Western canon was evidence that the West and the democratic way of life and the anti-communist way of life was the best one possible. And nowadays, it just seems that we live in a technocratic world, and you see that in the mainstream Democratic Party, which is where I think it's most troubling and problematic. Not that nobody cares about culture, but it doesn't have the urgency that it clearly did for the CIA to have been funding it secretly.
We're talking with Joel Whitney. He's the author of the book, Finks, How the CIA Tricked the World's Best Writers. The CIA started the Paris Review to cover up the activities of one of its leading lights, Peter Matheson. Doc Humes, who you mentioned a moment or two ago, was asking Matheson, I guess, or others were asking Matheson to come forward. Is that right? And to tell the truth. And they said no. But just for our audience, Paris Review launched, according to your book, the careers of William Styron, Terry Southern, T.C. Boyle, and Philip Roth, among others. I'm reading from the beginning pages of your book. It threw legendary parties where, for decades, actors like Warren Beatty, who was a prominent progressive, and political and cultural figures like Jackie Kennedy would rub shoulders with New York City's writers and book publishing rank and file. Its editor-in-chief, Plimpton, that's George Plimpton, was already a best-selling author, a friend of the Kennedys, one of Esquire magazine's most, quote, attractive men in America, close quote, and according to Norman Mailer, the most popular man in New York City. Now, what's important about this book, I think, is that the Cold War, which is a poorly named description of what was, in essence, a worldwide, global, multi-tiered confrontation between two different social orders. It appeared as a struggle between nations because it took that form, but it was in fact a war between two social systems. One was capitalism and one was either, you might call it socialist or yearning to be socialist, had a socialist perspective. And one of the things that's noteworthy about this whole period, this whole half century, was that the U.S. government, through the CIA, but through every conceivable opinion molding outlet, that would be academia, that would be culture, that would be recreation, sports, politics, you name it, was in combat against communism. And so in order to win the war of ideas against communism, which was a rising phenomena, started with the Russian Revolution in 1917 after World War II, it spread the Chinese Revolution, North Vietnam, North Korea. Of course, the Red Army from the Soviet Union was the liberating force in Eastern and Central Europe that liberated those countries from Nazism and then occupied those countries and created socialist governments. And all around the world, people who were rising up in national liberation movements had to choose, will we be with the socialist camp or with the capitalist camp? And there was a competition between these two camps. I think the U.S. ruling elites realized that you couldn't defeat the idea of communism simply by having a right-wing conservative presentation. There needed to also be a left-wing liberal presentation that was also anti-communist.
Well, Pete Seeger once said that the strongest anti-communists were socialists.
And you can see, and I was also note, I read an earlier book, Joel, called The Cultural Cold War, The CIA and the World of Arts and Letters, in the same vein as your book. And it was quite clear that the CIA was actually making a move for socialists who were not communists and financing them. In other words, as a deliberate a part of this architecture, which was an ideology while socialist or left would be decidedly anti-communist. Go ahead.
That seemed that one of the lessons they learned in places like Latin America, for instance, was that if you're trying to win over members of the left who you think have gone too far to the dark side, which is how they saw it, then you're certainly not going to do it with blatant McCarthyite rhetoric. And certainly, in particular, intellectuals around the world, I guess just throughout time, tend to be the sophisticated ones, and they tend to be the ones that were falling for these romantic ideas that, after your national independence movement comes to power, you can rethink how government works vis-a-vis democracy, capitalism, and socialism. So to win over this, what they call the non-communist left, and they talked about it so frequently that it gets frequently abbreviated, NCL, you would need the left to be your champion. So for instance, in Latin America, it took them a while to learn this, actually. So Latin America ended up with something like half a dozen to maybe closer to 10 magazines that were either created or funded by the CIA. The first one was called Notebooks for Cultural Freedom, and it had very small following because it sounded, as one person involved in it described it later, as like cultural McCarthyism. So what they learned to do was to find democratic socialists and leftists and put them on the cover. And they would have their budding neoconservatives writing things, writing op-eds that were going closer to the center right, as they would have seen it in terms of anti-communism, in terms of economic ideas. Those guys would be doing the op-eds. That was one tier. And then on the cover, you would have the cultural cachet of people like Gabriel Garcia Marquez. So one of the things I show events around the Cuban Revolution, I show it from George Plimpton's point of view because he followed Hemingway to Cuba in that period. And then I show it from Gabriel Garcia Marquez's point of view. And one of those eureka moments that I mentioned earlier in our talk is I was digging through the papers of a somewhat obscure cultural figure in the Princeton Library archives, and I found a folder with some letters from Garcia Marquez, and I realized that when the CIA's magazine Mundo Nuevo snuck him onto its cover and into its pages in the mid-60s, it was after a long period where he'd fought for socialist values. He was mostly on the side of the Cuban Revolution. He was adamantly anti-imperialist. And he would never have willingly come into the pages of a CIA magazine. The fact that it was described ended up getting him into those pages. In fact, it was a pair of excerpts of his masterpiece, 100 Years of Solitude, that the CIA's editor, who probably knew he was working for the CIA, got into that magazine. And when Garcia Marquez found out about it, this chapter, by the way, I've excerpted in the magazine, The Baffler, he was not just surprised, he was quite annoyed, and he promised never to write for that editor or that magazine again.
I was wondering, too, if you could tell our listeners about several of these other high-profile, like very high-profile cultural icons around Europe at the time, who, whether wittingly or unwittingly, had something to do with this program.
Yeah. one of the things I tried to find out if I was going to bring in, for instance, a Nobel Prize winner like Hemingway or Pablo Neruda or Garcia Marquez himself or their European equivalents, I always tried to find out what they thought of being in the pages of a CIA magazine. Some were quite willing. Hemingway, it doesn't look like he was ever told when he was, I mean, the place where you find him in a CIA-sponsored magazine is the Paris Review. And just to circle back, the Paris Review, like your question at the beginning was like, who knew? And it seems like Matheson knew that he had started it as part of his cover as a spy. But he also says he quit the CIA before it even launched. So to the members of the editorial team of the Paris Review after Matheson is hardly involved except as a symbolic founder, it would have seemed rather academic to go and tell someone like Hemingway that the interview that they just ran was in a magazine that was once doing stuff with the CIA. Well, that's how they presented it to Doc Humes. And they, of course, would have been one of the places, Encounter being another, where some of these illustrious European intellectuals would appear. It's a different matter with Encounter. Encounter was being actively open, well, not openly, semi-secretly funded by the CIA. It was an official CIA magazine. But the clever thing about the structure of the CIA funding was its secrecy, so that whereas the Russians in the 50s and 60s were funding, I mean, some of their assets were probably secret, but it was an open secret. And the Americans kept their secret maybe a little bit better and a little bit longer, and the assumption was that this would help it work better. So those very people you mentioned, those Nobel Prize winners, the Pulitzer Prize winners, people who were also writing for The New Yorker and The New York Times, they all had plausible deniability the same way a CIA agent would or a president would by using the CIA. The fact of its secrecy meant that some of them who probably knew could pretend that they didn't know. And that's what made it both effective, as the creators of this program would have seen it, and to me very problematic, because what you end up having is kind of a secrecy regime ruling over the press. And I think with openly funded outlets like, say, the BBC, I mean, it's a little more complicated than a British government-funded thing. I think there's a private corporation that works on behalf of the British government. It's somewhat better known that it's effectively, if you don't use the bad version of this word, propaganda, it's effectively propaganda. With stuff that's done more secretly, it's hard for people to know where you're coming from. So I guess it works better, but it's really problematic in terms of that high value we have in the sense of the Fourth Estate being ruled as the press should be ruled by transparency. It just doesn't work. So if you have these secret magazines, you have these intellectuals writing for them, and they don't know, and even if they think they might know, as Garcia Marquez himself once said in one of these letters, it's hard for them to be upset about it because they can, you know, later on pretend they didn't know.
John, I was working on the case to win the freedom for the Cuban Five, the five mm-hmm. members of Cuban intelligence who had infiltrated terrorist organizations in the United States on behalf of Cuban intelligence. They appeared to be defectors, but in fact, they were Cuban agents. They presented the Cuban government with information that there were going to be new terrorist bombings and actions from Florida. The Cuban government decided to give that information to the FBI. The FBI then went and arrested the Cuban Five, the ones who had provided the information about the terrorist actions, and kept them in prison for a long time until Obama pardoned them. I was working on that case for a long time. And through a series of FOIA requests from the National Committee to Free the Cuban Five, led by Gloria Lariva, following up on earlier FOIA requests from the Miami Herald newspaper, we learned that a whole number of the journalists for the Miami Herald who were writing stories, very negative, hostile stories about the Cuban Five before and during their trials and while the jury deliberated, were in fact also receiving money from Radio and TV Marti through the BBG, the Broadcast Board of Governors. And you know, when we made the point, you know, the U.S. government is barred from carrying out propaganda, open or surreptitious propaganda, towards the American people.
American citizens, that's right.
Like, that's, I can't remember
the name. It's against the law.
It's against the law. Yep. But nonetheless, they were doing it. But what we're learning, and what we're learning also from Joel Whitney's book, Finks, How the CIA Tricked the World's Best Writers, is this was customary. This was routine. This was important for U.S. intelligence operations during the entire period of the Cold War. And it was just one component. Writers were one. There was also, Joel, a big attention paid to musicians, to cultural figures. There was lots of sort of trips and sponsorships so that America could do war in the battle of ideas. And also notably, the U.S. was, through much of this operation, also promoting African-American artists like Louis Armstrong, Dizzy Gillespie, trying to sanitize the image of the United States, because, of course, the socialist or communist movement was making a great deal out about the fact that in America, African-American people lived under an apartheid system, segregation. It was a holistic approach to the issues of culture, literature, ideas. I mean, that's when you go through this research, that's what you're seeing.
Yeah, the CIA was chosen in part after World War II. The Western, the Allied troops and some of their officers watched in Berlin, the various quarters. The Allied troops were going over into the Soviet quarter, and they were doing that to watch films and to watch and hear symphonies. And the idea came that the West needed a Ministry of Culture. Well, certainly in the United States, in the pre-McCarthy and McCarthy era, just after World War II, nobody was going to be willing to fund that through traditional congressional funding. The arguments would have been too costly. The battles would have been lost. So the CIA had an unaccountable budget. So from the standpoint of many of the Western artists, some who took this money knowingly, it was a boon. It was like you had a benefactor. And many of them thought that beating totalitarian communism was a very noble cause, and recognizing that the Soviets and the Russians today do this as well. I mean, funding of news is a good thing. Getting the truth out there is a good thing. But you're also manipulating or controlling the version that you tell. So this stuff goes on today. It went on then. People were very divided when it was exposed over whether it was good or bad. And I think where I come down, it's just like, as long as we know what happened eventually, that's the important story to tell. Is to, the complexities of this will stay with us, especially as we seem to be entering a new era of animosity between the Russians and the Americans. And there are very many signs that this was something that democratic societies who believe in institutional transparency were taking a big risk in getting involved in. And that's what I tried to show in Finks. I tried to show that even if it's granted that the Soviets were doing propaganda, sometimes openly and sometimes sub rosa, they had, by definition, I would say, different standards, because they weren't a proud democracy touting their ways around the world. And if you are, then there comes a special responsibility with that bragging that we did and with that sort of self-advertising that we put out there for our way of life. And that is that institutions that lose their transparency will rot. That's what we apparently found out in the Enlightenment. And that's what led to our great system, with the fourth estate being the fourth check on the three systems of government. So what I try to show is that if there's a secrecy regime, not so much over the arts. That I think is complicated enough. But I tried to emphasize that on the journalism side, there can be no transparency if a secret organization is funding you. So that's where I came down, and that's why I thought that the book, it would be an interesting time to tell this story. I thought it would land in the era of Hillary Clinton, but alas, it has landed in the era of Trump.
Joel, tell me too, when you were doing your research, did you see any parallels to what is happening today?
Yeah, I think that this question of who were the toughest Cold Warriors and who were sort of the most antagonistic towards the enemy versus who were the most effective at creating something that is universally loved. My opinion, sort of, the goal was peace. The goal was to stop the tormenting in the Stalinist gulags. And sometimes what you saw was the antagonism was the antagonistic behavior was more effective through this. And some of the liberals were the most effective antagonizers of our opponents in the Cold War. And you're seeing some of that come back today. I feel like blaming the Russians in the Cold War, it was a clear way to avoid talking about human rights at home, talking about civil rights work that many important activists were doing. And so if you're pointing always at your sort of evil empire across several ponds and what they might be doing around the world or even here, you might be guilty of changing the subject from a debate that is much more self-critical, that is much more self-examining.
I agree with you. And there's one other piece to this, which is when you look at the mainstream media, the writers in the mainstream media, they don't have to be really CIA agents, either willingly or unwillingly, because in essence, they're just echoing whatever the U.S. government line is. There's no, I mean, here at Sputnik, actually, we have a lot of diversity of viewpoints. But when you look at MSNBC or CNN or you read The Washington Post or The New York Times, when it comes to the big issues, say Syria or Libya or Russia or any of those things, there's almost complete homogeneity in terms of attitudes. And I don't know if that means all the reporters and the journalists just know that you have to toe the line or whether they're being instructed. Anyway, 20 seconds left. You get the last word.
Yeah, I think that's exactly why it worked so well, is that if you were coming up as an intellectual in the Cold War, as a journalist, as a pundit, you sort of knew. It's to me, the original political correctness is what you could or couldn't say during the Cold War. And that's the hangover we're living with now. And I think that was why I wanted to examine it in these times that we're in.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined from Brooklyn, New York by Joel Whitney. Joel is the co-founder of Guernica, a magazine of arts and politics. He's the author of the book, Finks, How the CIA Tricked the World's Best Writers. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.